Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Jan Doolittle Wilson is back. Jan and I always have the same problem. We always talk for too long. We always lose ourselves in the conversation. And then I don't know what to edit out because it was all very interesting. And so here's what I did this week. There was a moment where I went off on this crazy literary theory about Dante's Inferno. I've gone ahead and cut that out and I put it in the bird's eye view section. So if you don't want to hear me monologue about that, just end this thing after Steve and I finish. Steve and I talk about one of the few episodes that you can just say the name of the episode and everyone knows what you're talking about. He reacts this week to Hardhome. Without further ado, here is Jan Doolittle Wilson. Jan Wilson, welcome back to Electric Boogaloo.
Thank you, Anthony. I'm so thrilled to be back. Thank you for inviting me again.
Yeah, I always look forward to this. Every now and again, I'll have a new guest on and I'll think, this is exciting. A new person I haven't talked to. They're going to have new insights about Game of Thrones and I'll get to learn something new about the book. But there's something nice as well in a different way about talking about this book with someone who you've talked about it 3 or 4 times already with.
Right. You can kind of fall into a rhythm.
Yes.
It was so funny. I was talking to my husband about this and I said, so Anthony invited me to do another podcast episode. And I said, do you think this will be our 4th one? Can I now call myself a regular contributor to the podcast?
I think
I need that title, Anthony. I think that
regular. That's how we will introduce you. Regular.
Okay.
Friend of the podcast.
Friend of the podcast. Regular contributor. Mm-hmm. I think with number 4.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I need to be maybe bumped up a
little
bit.
We've upgraded you from repeat offender to regular contributor.
Maybe that's more accurate though, the repeat offender. I don't know. But it's very nice to be back.
Yeah, good. Now, it's the other thing about it, this about having someone back on who you've talked to a few times already is that as you're reading the chapter, you think, oh, I wonder what Jan will think about this.
Same. I have so many questions for you about this chapter because I know you a little bit now and I'm thinking I can see some things here that I think Anthony might have some particular views on.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Now let me pull up I was grading papers and I have a bunch of Word documents open.
It's that time of year, papers.
And I need to find my synopsis. All right. Here's my synopsis of the chapter. Ned is woken from a dream and is taken to King Robert. The king has been impaled by a boar and lies dying on his bed. Ned learns that Robert, while drunk, commanded his hunting party to allow him to face the beast alone. Robert's spear missed the mark, and the boar impaled him deeply and ripped open his stomach. After multiple days on the road back to King's Landing, the wound has become mortal, and Ned can smell the death of it. Robert commands his attendants to leave and apologizes to Ned for being a bad king. He then commands Ned to write out his will of succession. Ned writes down the king's words, but omits the name Joffrey in favor of the phrase, my heir. The old friends say their goodbyes. Ned consoles Barristan and has a brief exchange with Varys. Then he is met by Renly on his way back to his room. Renly tells Ned to remove Cersei from her children and seize power. Ned refuses. Ned drafts a letter to Stannis and calls for Littlefinger. Littlefinger seems to know everything already, and so he also tells Ned...
Of course he does.
Yes, of course. He also tells Ned to seize power and rule through Joffrey. Ned refuses. Instead, he gets Baelish to buy off the men of the City Watch in case a battle is warranted. Baelish mocks Ned one more time before promising him the required soldiers. So, Jan Doolittle Wilson, what do you want to talk about? Shall we talk about a character, a theme, a plot point, or shall we climb once more the ladder of chaos?
Well, I think we're going to have to talk about Ned and some of his, once again, terrible choices. Two things, and then you can go... whichever thread of this you want, Anthony, but
Sounds a lot like
in kind of,
chaos, Jen.
it's okay, let's just go the chaos ladder then. I reread the chapter a couple of times in preparation for our talk today, and then I went back through and I thought, okay, I'm just going to hit every kind of Ned chapter and just kind of revisit some of this, and I couldn't decide in which chapter Ned commits his greatest folly. Is it this chapter, or is it the previous Ned chapter where he openly confronts Cersei in the courtyard? But I think that's right. The big thing that we have to kind of explore is just mistake after mistake that Ned makes in this chapter. But then I also have to give just a shout out to Varys, because he is just the definition of passive aggressive, isn't he? I mean, I was laughing so hard as I went back through. He plays a relatively minor role in this chapter. He's not the star, but what he does with the little time he has in this chapter is just beautiful. Just this line about, Lancel, oh, poor dear boy. I hope he's not too upset, right? He just slips in these wonderful moments where he says one thing, but he means something entirely different.
He
And
means the
nobody
opposite.
does it.
That's right.
Oh, nobody does it like Varys. So I enjoy him. And this chapter
Well,
reminded me why I enjoy him.
yes, I think that with Varys, especially with this chapter, you really have to pay attention to what he's saying because he, like you said, he doesn't talk often. But if you don't carefully look at his words, you will miss the plot
You
entirely.
will miss the plot because he so rarely says what he actually means. And that's true for a lot of characters, but nobody quite does it the way Ferris does. He doesn't say what he means, but he says exactly what he means at the same time.
That's
Does
right.
that kind of make sense?
It absolutely makes sense. I mean, if you were to look, contrast him with Littlefinger,
Yes.
Littlefinger also conceals, but he conceals by being so blunt that it's
Yes.
off-putting, right? Whereas
Yes.
Varys is, he's mastered subtlety to the point where you're like, oh, geez, now I gotta think about what you're saying like three times over to
Yes.
figure out what, because I know you're trying to tell me something.
The juxtaposition, I think that's exactly right, Anthony, between Varys and Littlefinger, who share a lot of similarities, but the way they go about it. So you're right. I mean, I think Varys carefully kind of codes what he says in this kind of passive aggressive way, where he's definitely making a suggestion about what he says, but he kind of goes all around it. And then Littlefinger, he knows exactly who he's talking to when. And he just comes out with really just the naked truth, but he knows that what he says will be interpreted a certain way depending on the audience. So he tells Ned exactly what he thinks here. He doesn't really speak in code at all, right? He basically just tells Ned, this is what you should do. This is what I think, knowing that Ned's not going to do it, so it's not a risk to tell him the truth.
That's right. You know, the third name that we could throw in here for this chapter is Renly.
Yes. Oh, Renly.
Because I think that Renly has had some interesting speaking parts in this book, but for the most part, he's held his cards very close to his chest.
Yes. Yes.
You know, every now and again, he'll say something that will either be kind of a humorous release valve, or he'll say something blunt about his brother. But for the most part, unless you've been carefully watching Renly, you don't know that he has designs for the throne.
Right. You wouldn't guess it really until this moment.
And so his strategy was simply to say nothing to anyone until the time was perfect,
Right.
and then kind of spring into action. And of
Spring into
course,
action.
it's so surprising to Ned that it doesn't actually work, and who knows if it would have worked anyway.
Right.
All of these creatures, these political creatures, are kind of hiding in plain sight,
Yes.
and each has something of a different approach to Ned, or maybe Ned perceives them slightly in different ways. But I love that each of these three characters has a play in this chapter.
And the other thing that really strikes me, this is such a fascinating chapter. Not only do we just get further insight into, we know Ned at this point, we know exactly where Ned's going. We are screaming the whole time because we can see the mistakes unfolding. But it's kind of the theme of the book, right? We see the game in full play here in ways that maybe we haven't before because we have so many actors at the same time. And you're right, they're all coming at the game in a different language, a different strategy. But the one constant is they know Ned. Ned has been Ned from day one. They know exactly what his vulnerabilities are.
And he doesn't know them at all.
He doesn't know them. And he just is on this stubborn path. If I just do the right thing, it will come out right in the end. And he is way in over his head.
Okay,
But
I agree with everything you just said. I'm gonna quibble with one little thing.
okay, go.
All right, so in this chapter, Ned doesn't do the right thing. I mean, I guess in terms of like just a straightforward approach, he decides to lie.
He does.
And there's actually three instances of Ned's troubled conscious of times when he's decided to what he thinks is a necessary lie, but it really bothers him. So we have this memory of Lyanna, and of course we're not supposed to know yet what the lie of Jon Snow is, but it still continues to trouble him. It haunts him. It haunts his dreams, right? And then he does this thing with Robert where he doesn't write down what he says. He writes down my heir instead of writing down Joffrey, and he lets Robert believe that he had written down Joffrey. And then the third thing is, of course, he decides not to tell Robert about any of this. He lets Robert go to his grave saying, you know, take care of my children. And he knows, okay, well, I know you think you mean Cersei's children, and I'm going to tell you that I'll take care of them like they're my own. But the faces that run through Ned's head at that point are like Gendry and Mia and Barra. You know, these are, he knows that to take care of Ned's children really means to take care of his bastards. And in all of those ways, Ned is choosing to deceive. So I guess I just want to say he's trying to be deceptive, you know.
He is,
He's trying to play the game to the best of his ability. But it's not because of the lack of trying. It's not that he's just like, I'm going to tell the truth at all costs. That is part of his problem. But the problem, I think the bigger problem is that that's his default setting. And so when he does try to lie, he's like a guy who's trying to dance for the first time. He's just not good at it.
He's not good at it. I was laughing, Anthony, when you were talking because I was going to my counterpoint was going to be, well, in the scene where he promises to take care of the children, for him, it's not really a lie because he's thinking of the other children. So he can say, but as my mother used to say, if you know what the person means, it's still a lie, right? If you know that the meaning is one thing and you choose to take a different meaning, that's still a lie. So you're right. He's trying everything he can to get around the lie, right? But he knows it's still a deception. He knows it's a betrayal. And then really the greatest betrayal is writing to Stannis, right? And he knows that Robert wants him to protect Joffrey. He wants him to be regent. And yet he knows the truth that Joffrey shouldn't be on the throne. And so he's going to really kind of destroy what Robert wanted in, with his dying breath and write to Stannis and claim that Stannis is the rightful heir. You're right. There are these deceptions, but the fact that he is such a noble, honest man, I think Littlefinger, I'm flipping to the page. Littlefinger, I think, has the best line, as he often does, you know, when he speaks in these chapters. But the line where he says, "You wear your honor like a suit of armor, Stark. You think it keeps you safe, but all it does is weigh you down and make it hard for you to move."
I
And I
underline
think
that
that
too.
captures what you just said, right? That he has this suit of armor, he has this moral code. And even, you know, if he steps outside of that a little bit in the examples that you gave, it's the honor itself that still weighs him down
I
and
think
either
you're
plagues
right.
him with guilt or just makes him really, really bad at the game, which we know day one. Ned doesn't like the game. He doesn't want to play the game. He has no interest in the game. And yet he is at the center of a game that he doesn't really want, really. I was getting ready to say he doesn't understand the game. Do you think that's fair? That he does he understand it? He just doesn't want to participate? Or does he not fundamentally understand the rules of the game? What do you think?
I think I have an answer to that. Let me say one more thing about the line that you I wanted to
Yeah, go
talk
ahead.
about that line that Littlefinger said. I wrote down Vardis Egan in the margin
Oh, uh-huh.
when he said that, because just a few chapters previous, we had this trial by combat between Braun, who is this sort of cutthroat, he's this free riding guy, he doesn't wear armor. He's gonna fight dirty, right?
Yeah.
And then you've got this Knight of the Vale, Sir Vardis Egan, who's like gleaming from head to toe with armor, and of course, he can't fight. He can't fight in it.
Yeah, that's a really great analogy.
The fact that Braun is willing to like do anything to win, making him a bad knight, right? He's not a knight.
Yeah.
But that Braun is willing to do anything to win gives him an advantage, and then it's almost like the honorable knight is never going to be able to match up.
Yeah.
Whatever his skill level, however strong his armor is, there's going to be chinks, and the killer's going to win.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a great little sort of callback, I
Oh,
think.
yeah. That's great.
In answer to your question, I've been thinking about this a lot. I think that Ned is under the assumption that people are lying and playing the game, but deep down inside, they will feel shame if you expose their sins, because that's how he feels.
Yeah.
So he said, he thinks going to the Godswood and revealing to Cersei that he knows the truth, that she's gonna like blush and run because, because of course
Yeah.
that's what any good woman should do, when her sexuality is revealed or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I just feel like he doesn't know that that way, 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 way down deep, Littlefinger, the core of his personality is a political creature. There's nothing that's underneath the surface that is a man of honor.
Yeah.
And I think that he misjudges people because of that. I think that he thinks, all right, everyone's doing what I'm doing. They might be better at it, but deep down, there is this core sense of honor that they will adhere to. And he's wrong. He's just
He's
wrong.
wrong.
There's
Well,
nothing underneath Robert. He's a glutton all the way down. He's a fool all the way down.
I was going to use Robert though as maybe a way of kind of affirming that point of view for Ned to a certain extent, because Robert does feel shame. You know, in this chapter, you kind of see it when he admits that, okay, sending the assassin after Daenerys. I guess that was kind of bad. You know, he's able to admit that on his deathbed. There's a previous chapter where, you know, he confronts him with the assassination plot, and you know, Robert with his bluster and his purple face and his rage, Ned can sense that there's still that conscience in there somewhere. You know, there is still that Robert I used to know. So I think you do get hints of that, you know, from Robert here, but
Interesting.
you know, very few people outside of Ned and maybe even Robert operate that way. And I think you're right. It's Ned's inability to really, really understand or grasp that. The other thing I wanted to say about Cersei, I was really struck by, again, is it naivete? Is it he expects everyone else to kind of have what he has, you know, nobility, duty, honor. But he has this conversation with Cersei, and not to, you know, keep going back to previous chapters, but in rereading this, I was really struck with how, you know, he confronts her about the parentage. He confronts her about Jaime being the father of the children. And she just doesn't even miss a beat. Yes, of course, thank the gods. You know, thank the gods they're not Roberts. And he is so surprised by her reaction. She doesn't have shame. She doesn't have any hesitancy. She doesn't try to get out of it or make excuses. It's just, nope, they're Jaime's, thank the gods. And he says to her, what could this man have done to you to make you hate him so much? And it's like, really, Ned? You haven't been watching the way these two interact. And I'm not saying Cersei's blameless by any means, but just the utter disrespect respect that Robert has for Cersei, the utter disdain, the physical abuse. And then he has the nerve to look at Cersei and say, "What could he have done to make you hate him?"
Right.
It just, I think it gives insight into just Ned's, you know, he often says Robert just turns away from things he doesn't want to see. Well, I think Ned just doesn't see so much of the time because he has maybe this armor, you know, that you mentioned. What do you think about that? I was really struck by that conversation where I thought, really, Ned, you're asking Cersei why she hates Robert.
Yeah. It's interesting.
I defend Cersei a lot on this
You
podcast. I'm not sure
do.
why.
You do. I wonder if.
We need to do a Cersei chapter when Cersei comes into play.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I have never felt any sense of sympathy for Robert.
It's hard. It's hard.
Because I think he's acting foolishly and but he's smart enough to know that he's acting foolishly. But he continues to do it. Every move he makes beggars the kingdom. Every move he makes makes things worse with he doesn't really see Ned for who he is. He doesn't really see Cersei for who she is. And he doesn't really care. He really doesn't care.
Nor does he really love Lyanna, in my opinion. He
I
barely
will
knew her. It's a
Oh, okay.
possession.
That's interesting. I think he thinks he does, right?
He thinks he does. Here's a woman he barely spent any time with, right? They are betrothed. I think it's a matter of somebody took what is mine, and it has fueled all of his hate and anger and desire for revenge. It fuels his hatred of the Targaryens. It doesn't allow him to show any affection toward Cersei. Everything kind of comes from that. But I don't think the love is really even genuine. I think it's Robert saying again, somebody took what was mine. And he has really no interest in being king. He's a terrible king. But he wants Ned to come right to King's Landing. So Ned can kind of do all the king things, and he can just, what does he say, whore and drink and, you know, be
Exactly.
Robert. He wants to keep
That's
being
right.
Robert.
And yet, I think that there is a sense that Cersei has a lot more power in that relationship than anyone has really acknowledged.
Agreed.
I think it's easy to point to Robert to as look, this guy's abusive. This guy's a philanderer. This guy's foolish. He is the in all of those ways, it's true. He's a horrible king, he's a horrible husband. And yet Cersei has so much power. She's so much smarter. She knows exactly how to she knows where all of the chinks in his armor are, and she'll wait for the exact right time to really question his masculinity or, declare that he can't fight in the in the melee because she knows that he's gonna, he knows he's gonna wanna fight in the melee if she says that. She's just thinking circles around him the entire book. And that little bit of it makes me think, Cersei's got a lot more power than she's given credit for here.
She does. She absolutely does. And, you know, we were saying before how one of Ned's biggest flaws is he's just so easy to read, right? Ned is who he is. And once you spend 5 minutes in his company, you know exactly who Ned is. Ned's probably not going to change, right? I think you're right. There are a couple little deceptions here and there, but Ned's Ned. And, you know, that makes his situation extremely dangerous because he is so easy to read. People know it 10 moves ahead of Ned. They know exactly what Ned's going to do. It's why it's not a risk for Littlefinger to tell him the truth. It's why, you know, I kept putting in my notes, wow, Cersei, you didn't leave. I think of, like you said, a rational person, if they're confronted with, you know, I'm going to tell Robert and you better run because he's going to come after you. I think I don't want to say normal, but a person in most situations, I think, would flee. She sticks around because she knows, I think she knows Ned, right? She knows that Ned will not have the heart to tell Robert on his deathbed the truth. She has this planned out 10 chess moves ahead. You know, everybody kind
Or
of knows
she
Ned.
knows that, look, if I flee, that's an admission of guilt.
It's an admission of guilt,
I'm going
and
to
then I.
stand firm. I'm going to call this guy a liar. And who's going to, it's my word against his.
And
my
that means
narrative
I
is
lose and I
stronger.
can't lose. I will not lose, right? But going back to your point about Robert, you know, Robert, I think, has the same flaw in some ways, not the nobility part, right? But Robert's so easy to read too. I mean, Robert is who Robert is and hasn't really changed since he was a boy. And so you're right. It, you know, Cersei, who is pretty crafty in her own right, because she knows him so well, she knows exactly what his weaknesses are. She knows exactly, you know, like you said, if I tell him one thing, he'll do the other. So I will tell him this one thing. And it puts him obviously in a really dangerous position. And we know what happens to Robert at the end of this chapter. It spells the death of him, right? So I think Ned and Robert are quite a bit alike in that way.
One more thing about Ned's deception. He has this line where he says, the lies we tell for love. Like he's he thinks that after he's had that exchange with Robert. He says, the lies we tell for love. And to me, that sounded like Jamie.
Yes.
When
I
he pushes Bran
too.
out the window, he says, the things we do for love.
Yes.
I thought that was a very interesting parallel. I mean, these two guys couldn't be more different, and yet they have a very, you know, that line almost echoes Jamie.
And maybe we can explore that, Anthony, because I thought the exact same thing as you. I put in my notes and in the margin, ooh, this sounds similar to that moment at the window, right? But think about how often Ned and Jamie are deliberately juxtaposed, not just in this chapter, but really throughout the book and even later, right? So we get that moment in the throne room, right? Jamie's on the throne. Ned comes in after, you know, the defeat of the Targaryens. There's a chapter, right, titled The Lion and the Wolf. I mean, there are so many moments where these two characters are deliberately, well, even if you go back to the previous chapter, right, the previous Ned chapter, the one before this one, where he's having that conversation with Cersei, and she says, what would you do for love? And he thinks back after she admits, right, that basically they, or Jamie pushed Bran out the window. What would you do to protect your children? And Ned has that moment of doubt where he thinks, what would I do if the lives of my children were at stake? Would I do something horrible?
And he, I also remember writing, he also thinks, what would Kat, like, I know what I would do.
What would Kat do?
Kat would do like 10 times worse. Like that's his view of her because of the way she's treated Jon Snow. But you're right. And then you actually have those two square off outside of a brothel.
Yes. The big fight.
Yes. The big fight. So you, yes, that's right. You always, it's pretty common to see Ned and Jamie juxtaposed in that way.
And then we learn, right? We learn later why Jamie does what he does. We know early on, you know, Jamie pushes Bran to protect Cersei.
Right.
But we also learn a lot more about why he did what he did, you know, to the Mad King, breaking his oath, and which continue, you know, I love Jamie. It continues to just plague Jamie, and it, he's kind of haunted by that, maybe in the same way that Ned is haunted by Lyanna, you know, the promise he has to make to Lyanna, which you could, people just poke that bear again and again and again, like, oh, well, you did the same thing in your marriage. You know, people are constantly raising this, well, you've got this code of nobility and honor around you, Ned, but you cheated on Kat. You had a, you know, quote unquote bastard son. And you can just see, he can't tell them the truth. He can't ever reveal, well, actually, no, I didn't. He can't ever say that, but you know, it just rankles him.
Well, and you have that parallel with Jamie because the reputation doesn't match the truth. Ned's reputation is that he's a philanderer. Not like serial, but he's got a bastard. And
he's,
this is an
bastard,
otherwise
son,
chink in his honor or whatever.
Right.
And of course, Jamie's the Kingslayer.
Yes.
Where, you know, and that's actually true that he did. And you could argue, you know, whether that actually betrayed a vow or not. But the truth of the matter is that he saved the city. But that bit of his reputation is not what defines his legacy.
Right.
I think Jamie learns at a very young age, like he's 16 years old when he learns that it's impossible to live up to these vows.
Yes.
These vows are impossible. I can't obey the father of the realm and obey my own father at the same time. I can't save the city and not kill the king.
Yeah.
So these vows are bullshit. And now I know. Now I know. And I'm going to live accordingly. Ned never has that crucible moment. He never decides, well, all of my honor or all my code or whatever is bullshit. He still really believes it.
He does.
And it has worked for him until now, you know?
Yeah. And the only other time, you know, heartbreaking, again, you can just, of course, in hindsight, we know what happens to Ned. But, you know, even if you're reading this for the first time, you just kind of see this falling into place. You know, going back to that chapter with Cersei, where he has that moment of, oh, okay, what would I do? You know, what have I done to protect the people I love? And then, of course, that last straw, right? The moment where he really goes beyond his own moral code is when he confesses to treason to save Sansa, right? That's really the moment where he is finally confronted with, okay, I am willing to lie and take these steps and completely debase myself in this way because I'm doing it for somebody I love, to protect somebody I love. And, you know, you see these moments with different characters where they have to make that decision. And it's really fascinating to see the different ways that plays out. And then the other thing I was thinking about too is, you know, when you were talking about Jamie, do I keep my vow to uphold and protect the institution, or do I protect the people? And there's a great line. I don't think it's in this chapter. It was one of the previous chapters I was looking at, where I think it's with the Dothraki. And Daenerys was talking about how, you know, with the Kingsguard, it doesn't really matter who is king. If you are Kingsguard, you protect the king. And it doesn't matter who that king is. So much that Barristan, you know, fought for the Targaryens, and now he's working for Robert, right? It's the institution.
That's right.
With the Dothraki, it's the person. And I thought, how, that's a neat bit of foreshadowing, you know, in those early chapters with Dany, where she's learning about the Dothraki and how different they are from, you know, the Kingsguard of Westeros. And I'm not sure where I'm going with this. We're still on the, you know, ladder of chaos, but I thought it is kind of reflective in some ways of how different characters, where they see their loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
Is it to family, person, blood, or is it to these higher ideals that should go beyond these personal relationships? And Ned thinks he's in the former, but actually ends up in the latter.
You know, Selmy is actually another guy in this chapter who is dealing with some contradictions, because the way it's described is that, you know, Robert's reeling from being drunk in the saddle.
Yeah.
And he tells everyone to step back. He's going to take the boar. Selmy knows this is a bad idea. His job is to save the king's life.
Yeah.
And yet his job is also to obey the king. And there's no way he can do both. He chooses to obey the king rather than to save the king's life.
Right.
And he just feels horrible about it. And I think it just goes back to the impossibility that a lot of these characters are in. And I think Ned more than anyone.
Yeah.
I think you're right. We've seen a series of bad decisions on Ned's part. But in each case, the decision makes sense to Ned. And that's why this is such a wonderful... I have come to appreciate his character more and more since I've done this rewatch. Because it's true to his character.
Yeah.
You know, everything he does, you think, well, it's actually from a Ned point of view, this is actually the most Ned-ish thing you could do right now. You know, if he starts playing chess at this stage of the game, you're going to think, that's not Ned. He's Ned's the checkers guy. Come on. Be true to the character, George. Ned is true to his character like no other character in this book.
Yeah,
and so
it's true.
He makes sense. He makes sense. I get a little comfort that Ned's always going to be Ned all the way down.
It's true. I go back and forth on Ned. I think part of my impressions of Ned are maybe at this point inevitably influenced by just Sean Bean's interpretation, because I love Sean Bean so much. So it's kind of hard at this point, right? I think with so many of our characters, to separate actor from, you know, book character. But if you just, you know, kind of go back to book Ned, You're right. I mean, you can't. Maybe we're expecting too much of Ned. It's frustrating though. You get to this part where you think he's talking to is it, I think it's the conversation with Littlefinger. Is it Littlefinger? Yeah, this is 428, where Ned again, have you learned nothing from Littlefinger? Have you no honor? Of course he has no honor. You're just now learning this. And then, Littlefinger, of course, very
He
sardonically,
says,
oh, a
"Don't you have a
shred, surely,
shred of honor?"
right?
He's like, "Yeah, I've got a shred."
A shred, right? And then, Littlefinger spells it out for him and says, okay, think 10 moves ahead, right? You're right. Ned is checkers and, Littlefinger is chess. Littlefinger is saying, look at the big picture because put Stannis on the throne. Great. That might be the right thing to do. That might be the noble thing to do, but think about the consequences. If you put Stannis on the throne, he's going to start a war. He's going to go after all of the enemies. He's going to go, Tywin's not going to allow this slight on his daughter. He's going to come into the war. Think about all the people who are going to die. You can avoid all of that if you just stay quiet. You put Joffrey on the throne, you support the Lannisters, and then 4 years down the road, we can decide what happens. If you just think about the big picture, and Ned just can't or won't do that.
Yeah, and then
No.
Littlefinger says, "Okay, it's Stannis
Yeah.
and war. That's what you're choosing. You're choosing Stannis and war." And for Ned, it's like, this is not a conversation.
Yeah.
There's
It's not even a
Stannis is the
choice.
rightful heir. We do whatever it takes to put this guy's ass on the throne.
Yeah,
So
you're right.
it's,
He says Stannis is the heir. Nothing can change that. There's no seeming to this. This is what we do. And don't you love where Littlefinger says, oh, I forgot I was talking to a Stark. Never mind.
Yes, that's right.
It's one of my favorite lines in the chapter. Sorry, I forgot I was talking to a Stark.
I think at every step we can second guess Ned. I think that at the very beginning it's like, no, don't go south. This is bad. You're not suited for the south. But his,
What's
but
the
Cat,
line? No Stark who has ever gone south ends up in a good way, or I'm paraphrasing badly, but yeah, no
that's
Stark
right.
should ever go south.
And yet Catelyn's kicking him out the door.
Yep.
And Robert, his king and best friend, is saying, "I need you."
Yep.
And so, what is he to do? So it's like, of
What does
course,
he
that's
do
a
do?
bad decision, but what is he to do? And I think I could say that for every single one of these decisions.
Yeah.
Yes, quitting your office as Hand of the King over this assassination attempt, it's probably not the right thing to do. But what
Yeah.
is he to do? I think that that's what makes him compelling to me. It's like every single time I can see it's a bad decision, and yet if I think about it, I think, yeah, but would I have the, would I be smart enough to do something different in this situation? If I, I race like Ned, I think like Ned, this is probably what I would do. It's gonna end up with my death, but this is exactly what I'm gonna do.
Okay, let me play devil's advocate for just a second because you made me think of this, and I've also thought about this on my own. Do you think there's just a bit of, I want no part of this, I wash my hands of it, I just want to go back to Winterfell and consequences be damned aspect to Ned here? Because two things to back up what I'm saying. And again, this is a bit of devil's advocate on my part. I'm not sure I'm totally convinced of this, but if you look at 427, right, he's saying, okay, great, wrote the letter to Stannis. Here we go. The new king would choose his own hand. I'm free to go home. I'm going to go back to Kat in her bed. I can hear Rickon play, Bran's laughter. There's just this incredibly, it's heartwarming. You know what his desire is, but it's just this incredibly naive, great, all I have to do is write the letter. Stannis will come in. I can go home, right? Knowing, I think he knows this is going to be terrible, right? It's going to lead to war. If he stays in that position, he hates the throne. He doesn't want the power. He doesn't want to stay in King's Landing. But if he does stay, he can avoid all of this, right? He can use
Yeah,
his
it's a
moral
bit
influence for
self-serving,
good.
right?
That's kind of where I'm going. Is it an incredibly selfish thing to do?
That's right. He's been wanting to get back to Winterfell since the day he got there, right?
The day he got there,
And
even when
choosing
he throws his
Stannis,
hand pin at Robert, there's a bit of relief there. Like, thank God we can go home now, right? Is it selfish?
Yeah, it's a good point. He certainly does want to go home. I think that Stannis is maybe the quickest path home.
Yeah.
And yet, I don't think that he thinks that it's going to turn into war. I don't think that he's convinced that Cersei's going to do exactly what Renly says he's going to do.
Yeah.
I think he thinks he's continually underestimating Cersei. He thinks, okay, well, I've got it here. It's a piece of paper. I'm the ruler. And it doesn't matter what Cersei says because I got the seal of the king in my hand right now. And I know the truth. And as soon as Stannis is here, it'll all get sorted out. He really does think that that's the right, not just the right thing to do, but what will happen.
Yeah.
He doesn't think that Cersei's going to seize a throne through Joffrey in the next, what, like 3 hours?
Right.
All right. So because he doesn't believe that, I don't think he's making a decision based on the idea that, okay, well, this is actually the fastest way for me to get home. I think he thinks this is what has to be done. And thank the gods, I'm going home.
I'm going to have no part in this.
Yes.
Stannis will save the day. You know, I'm laughing, Anthony, when you said the piece of paper, the faith they put in a piece of paper, which in normal times, that would have been true. The king's seal, it was witnessed. It's the king's hand, right?
Mm-hmm. Again, underestimating and just Cersei.
Within
right?
2 seconds, she takes that scroll and just rips it up.
Yeah.
We're playing by a completely different set of rules now. And even, you know, even Selmy, you just tore up the scroll? How could you do that? Those were the king's words. And she's like, I don't care. We're in a completely new game now, where the things that used to mean something mean nothing now.
I don't know if it's in the books. I have to look at it. There's a scene in the show. It's later in the later seasons when Cersei like tears up a letter or something. And Tyrion says, you know, you've just really mastered the art of tearing up paper.
Yes. What is that?
I can't remember. I don't remember either. But when she tears it up, I immediately thought like, I can't see her tear it up without laughing at Tyrion's joke.
I think I'm harder on Ned than you are, but there were just so many times, not just in this chapter, but previous chapters, where I just wrote, Ned, do something, act on something.
Yeah.
Do you think that he lacks agency? Do you think that he just, if I don't act, maybe things will be okay? Is he driven by, you know, don't act too much so I can get back to Winterfell? What do you think is driving him here?
He might lack a certain imagination. I think that some of the things that are happening to Ned have never happened before.
Yeah.
You know, you walk in with a seal of the king. You know, you've got the law on your side. It's in the plain sight of everyone else in the room. Everyone knows that you've got the law on your side. The king's signature and seal are right here. You know, what queen has ever torn up a piece of paper like that before? I think he just lacks a little bit of imagination, and he's thinking, well, that's never happened before. It's probably not going to happen. Someone like Littlefinger would think, let me think of every possible thing that could happen.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to think, will they benefit from that? Because if they do, they might try it. And what would I do? Ned is not going to imagine the worst in people in the same way. And maybe that ends up being his downfall. The other thing is that he has such a moral aversion to bringing children into politics. And so when Renly comes up to him and says, here's what you need to do. I'm going to give you 100 swords. We're going to go separate Cersei from her children. That is going to be the smartest thing to do at this moment. And as readers, we're thinking, maybe that is the smartest thing to do at this moment. But Ned's thinking, how dare you suggest that I bring a child into this horrible political situation? We need to honor Robert's last wishes. You know, so that's his red line. We know that's his red line. He doesn't want to kill Daenerys. He doesn't agree with what happened to the Targaryen children. He hates that's part of Robert's legacy. And there's no way in hell he's going to separate Joffrey from Cersei. That's like the red line in the sand that he's not going to cross.
Right. I mean, it's his entire arc, right? The idea, he knows exactly what Robert would do if he found out about John. He knows exactly. He won't, so much so that he won't even tell Kat the truth. Mm-hmm. He is so afraid of that secret getting out and of John being vulnerable and of John being hurt, that even to his own wife, right? There's so many times I thought, just tell Kat. Just tell Kat, right? But he's so worried. He knows exactly what will happen if that gets out. But going back to your other point about this, again, this moral code and just, you know, he's been in King's Landing for a while. You would think that he would not be this naive. But when Littlefinger's having that conversation with him about, we're going to need more soldiers, we need more protection. And Ned says, well, let's just get the city watch. And Littlefinger says, yeah, we could get the city watch. They'll be loyal to me because I pay them. There are two interesting things about that. One is Ned's just assuming the city watch will be loyal because that's their job, right? Right. They're there to protect the city and they're there to protect the kingdom. And Littlefinger is saying, actually, no, they'll be loyal to whomever pays their salary. And that's
and
me,
I'm going to pay
way.
Them double just to make
and
sure.
And I'll pay them double. Right. And then that should have been Ned's clue that, Littlefinger controls the city watch. Mm-hmm. That's dangerous because Littlefinger is somebody not to be trusted, right? And again, I know it's easy in hindsight to say, oh, Ned, the minute Littlefinger said, I'm the one who pays their salary, whoa, right? And that's exactly what happens.
Well, I guess
then.
That's his other sin is that he trusts Littlefinger because he trusts Kat.
Because he trusts Kat. Yeah.
Because he thinks this is my wife's childhood friend. I don't like him. In fact, he mocks me every single time we talk. Right?
Yes.
And yet he's thinking, all right, Renly, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go talk to Littlefinger. Like, Varys is giving advice. Renly's giving him advice. He thinks, no, I need to turn to Littlefinger. I know what needs to be done, and I need Littlefinger's help. And he's totally blind to Littlefinger's true nature.
Yeah.
Which is hard to forgive, and yet it's like Littlefinger's dancing around everyone, you know?
But Littlefinger tells him how many times what his true nature is. Exactly. Every single time. I mean, even the conversation where he says, we can't do that. That's treason. And Littlefinger replies, only if we lose.
That's
I mean,
right.
That tells Ned everything he needs to know. Right. So Littlefinger, again, knowing Ned as he does.
Well, the fact that Littlefinger has known the entire time. He knows the entire time Cersei's secret. And this has been sort of, Ned's been hit going into what, like dozens of brothels. He hates it.
Yes.
He knows why. John Arryn's like Ned's dad, you know?
I know.
John
Arryn
raised him. And here this guy, Littlefinger, has known the whole time and he's just playing coy. I mean, that Ned should be angry. I mean, that's the thing. I think Ned should just be completely livid at Littlefinger for withholding that from him.
But, you know, here's again the thing that it's so beautiful about Littlefinger, knowing Ned the way he does, Littlefinger doesn't really hide much of anything with Ned. Mm. He basically tells him exactly who he is. He tells him exactly really what he's planning. Mm-hmm. I mean, he drops in these hints, knowing that Ned is just way too obtuse to really pick up on it. But he, for example, the part where, you know, Ned says, oh, by the way, I found out the big secret. The children are Jaime's. And Littlefinger says, how shocking. He doesn't even pretend to be surprised.
Exactly.
You know, he doesn't even try with Ned. It's like, this guy's adult. I'm going to say whatever I think because it's just not either going to sink in or Ned won't see it because he's too noble. Mm-hmm. It's so fascinating to revisit their conversations. Littlefinger is telling you everything you need to know, Ned. It's just what you choose to hear or what you choose to believe. And it's just, it's beautiful. You know, just the utter lack of, oh, really? You know, clearly showing Ned that he knew all along. If Ned had just dug a little further, he probably could have gotten to, oh, and by the way, I know about John Arryn too, right?
He does it so well. I mean, he does it. Really, we're finding out how good he is. I mean, I think with Littlefinger, it goes back to what we just learned in a previous chapter, is that He lost the woman that he loves, Kat, to a Stark.
The Stark.
And it was because he wasn't strong enough, he wasn't rich enough, he didn't have a high enough social status. And I think that really is his origin story. He feels like, you know what? That's never going to happen to me again. I'm going to play the long game. I'm going to become one of the most powerful people in the kingdom. And eventually, I'm going to get my revenge against the Starks. And if I can't have Kat, I'm going to have Kat version two,
Yeah.
in Sansa. I think that origin story for Littlefinger really drives his whole narrative. And in that way, here Ned is. He's the little brother of Brandon Stark. And if he can mock him, if he can torture him, if he can betray him in the end and make him look a fool, he absolutely is going to do that.
I completely agree. I think that does drive Littlefinger. I think it is this drive for power, but it's a power driven in itself by this idea that I was always the little guy. His name is Littlefinger. I mean, that's his nickname,
I
right?
know.
He's completely driven by the idea of everybody who looked down on me, underestimated me, thought I was unimportant, mocked me. Maybe I'm going to come back a hundredfold and I will show you all. And I'm going to climb up to the highest seat of power and then just destroy from within. And I do. I completely agree that that is what drives him and makes him so dangerous.
Notable introductions in this chapter. Maegor's Holdfast is introduced. We hear about the boar for the first time. Few characters, Sir Boros Blount is mentioned, and the introduction to the letter, Ned's paper shield. Short-lived though it is.
Yes.
And differences. This is all kind of framed differently in the books or in the show, particularly with Renly. I think it was just sort of an economy of space.
Right.
The show isn't sort of giving you a tour of Maegor's Holdfast. It's just sort of Renly approaches him in the hallway and says, "I should be king. Me. Stannis isn't a king. I am."
Yeah.
That's not exactly how Renly plays it in this particular. Renly gets him alone on the bridge and just says, "Look, I'm gonna put 100 swords in your hand. Here's what we need to do." He never says Stannis isn't a king. I am. So I think that's a pretty big difference for Renly.
Yeah.
Notable departure: Robert doesn't die, but these are Robert's last words, really. So we see Robert leave stage left, even though we don't find out that he's actually dead until later.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. He takes the milk of the poppy, says, "Well, I dream." And that's kind of where they leave him.
That's it. It's weird. It's like this guy was such a zero. Like he's just such a non he's just like this bumbling drunken fool
Yeah.
who isn't suited for the throne. He's such a zero, and yet when he's gone, that vacuum is enormous.
Yes.
Everything is going to fall apart. You've got this zero of a father figure, but as soon as the father figure is gone, like everything else falls apart.
Yes, he was a terrible king, but he's there, right? He's the symbol of the kingdom. He gives at least some sense of stability and unity,
Well,
right? To a kingdom
he gives
that's
off an aura of strength, even
of
if it's sort of
strength.
his legacy. It's like there is that political power just to pretending that you're strong,
And too, Anthony, think about this. I mean, how often, just using the United States as an example, how often have we put military leaders in the presidency who had really no business being there, but they're elected because they're a warrior, right? That
Exactly,
is
that's
the
exactly right.
epitome of like masculine strength, which is indispensable to the presidency, this idea of masculine strength.
It's
Who
as
better than a
old, it is as
soldier?
old as sin. It's like, who's going to be the leader of the tribe? Like the tallest guy. That guy over there, he's taller, so he's going to be leader. It really is this really primal, stupid thing, you know, that maybe people didn't even think about it. But it's like, yeah, if you want to be
the
leader,
guy whose guts are spilling out and he still manages to stab the boar through the eye. Yeah. He's very proud of that, too. Right. He's done. He says, I still got him, Ned. I still got him. He took me, but I made sure I got him. And I want you to, you know, serve him at my funeral feast. I mean, that's mm-hmm. Robert, right? That's that even in his dying yes. breath. Hey, I was strong.
He's planning a party in his with his final breath. They should have made him royal party planner. He would have been magnificent.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
And now Steve and I react to one of the most epic battle scenes in cinematic history. Here's my conversation about Hard Home with comic Steve Osborne. I don't know if you could be persuaded to do this, but I wonder if you guys could resolve to watch a single episode before we record again.
Yeah, we won't watch any tonight because I have trivia. Right.
That's fine. It's because the only reason I'm bringing it up is that I think it will take a little bit of willpower to say no to episode 10 after the end of episode 9. But if you're willing to do it, I do think that the conversation will be richer for it.
Okay.
So just keep that in mind.
I could also lie to you.
Well, you definitely could do that.
Let's just agree on that.
that you could lie to me.
Yeah, and that's as far as we need to go with that.
Let me just say that I'm excited about what comes next, and I'm excited to get your take on it, and I don't want to shortchange it.
Gotcha.
All right. Okay.
Well, maybe if you didn't live in Ohio.
I'm working on it, man.
I feel like you need to take some responsibility for this. You've been doing this whole Midwest thing for a while. It was cute. You know, yeah. Hey, look at this. It's a liberal guy who enjoys fresh vegetables and he's living in Ohio. This is a hilarious romp. But at some point, you know, it's like we're on what season are we on now? I feel like, yeah, we've seen this bit.
Well, I just remodeled my sunroom and
this is no one's tuning in for this.
No, I'm telling you that I think that before I remodeled the sunroom, I'd be like, yeah, no, just tell me when and where. I'll meet you at the airport. But I'm just let me enjoy my sunroom for a while. And then
I'm telling you, the audience give two shits about your sunroom.
They should visit. They should.
This is when the show starts believing that everything it does is interesting. And this is what brings the show down. They're like, oh yeah, no.
They're like,
everyone's like, oh, the sunroom. Yeah,
I got some sage.
They're like, the sunroom. I like this episode when it was a treehouse.
My sunroom is like the Dorn of my house.
Exactly. Somebody thinks this is a real important narrative.
Hey, man, I tell you what, if I was going to visit anywhere in Westeros, you know I'd visit Dorn.
You just want to get put in jail because you might want to see some boob.
I don't want to taste that boob poison, though. Because as soon as I look at those boobs, then the poison kicks in.
That's it, man. Do not sleep on that boob poison. It's the real deal.
All right, so here we go. Steve, do you remember when Winnie the Pooh got himself stuck in a hole?
I don't know that I've seen all of the Winnie the Pooh cartoon canon, but I sure feel like I've seen him stuck in a hole to the point where I'm like, is that every cartoon?
Yeah, every chapter, A.A. Milne, every single chapter, when it gets stuck in a different hole.
Yeah, learning nothing from the previous episode.
So I kind of feel like we found out why the Army of the Dead didn't incorporate Sam.
Because they can't run?
Well, these undead soldiers are just getting stuck in the hole in the wall of the hard hole.
Yeah. So there's no way that Sam.
I feel like half of the episode was just watching one of these zombies in the hole. Yeah. If Sam had been one of these zombies, it would have clogged the whole thing up. Then none of them would have got through.
Yeah. Forget about it. Just a bunch of zombies saying, oh, bother.
I do like that they finally answered that mystery of why the zombies let Sam go.
Because is it the king of these White Walkers, essentially just rabbit
trying to push poo from the back,
which was really one of the most sensual cartoons we'd ever seen growing up, because he's just rabbit just negging him the whole time, which I think is fascinating.
Absolutely negging him.
And but poo's just like, it's like the one thing he responds to.
Yeah, man, this episode was relentless.
It's a real good one. And so this is so.
And the weird thing about it is that I knew it was coming. This is an episode I've rewatched a few times because it's just that good. And every single time I watch it, I think, but when are we going to get to Hardhome? Like that, this is all. I remember that being sort of an epic battle scene. But there's so much run up to it.
Right. Unlike the King's Landing siege, right? Mm-hmm. Which is all King's Landing. Battle at Hardhome feels like it's more epic and it takes longer than the siege of King's Landing.
There was all kinds of stuff. There was the Cersei and Qyburn meeting in the dungeon.
Yeah.
There's the Sansa and Theon interaction.
You've got Tyrion's getting some wine with Dany, which just give me all that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's just so much that happens. And
it's like all of it's good.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So much is going on. And then finally, you just get hit like relentlessly in the forehead with this scene.
That's which just really took me, because I'm into all these other little subplots, and like each one of them I could have just watched a full episode of, and so that was a great job on their part. And then all of a sudden now I'm on this epic battle that I didn't see it coming, right? I mean, I legitimately didn't see this coming, and I it was so good that all the things that I was like upset I was leaving and hoping to go back to, I completely forgot about.
Now, you've seen a bit of zombies on screen in your days, right?
Oh yeah, probably more than I need.
So what was your feeling about these zombies?
I almost think that the fact that they were zombies was secondary.
Okay.
It was so well directed. So the fact that they're zombies adds to the fact that there are holes for them to eke through, and there's this relentlessness to it, and you don't really have the time to go, oh my gosh, it's zombies again, because it's just here it is, and the wreckage is so dramatic, and the sense of urgency from everywhere is so well done. You felt so present that.
Well, this was sort of the first mass attack, because we've seen them marching. I mean, we've seen them marching and marching and marching. And then we also saw the sort of Jojen pincushion episode.
Right.
But that was just a couple zombies.
And that was the first time we saw a little bit more like of this frenetic moving, right? Mm-hmm. So it was kind of nice to get a glimpse of like, you know, these things can go pretty fast, especially the skeletons. Them skeletons, man.
They can move.
We talked that's, about it.
You're supposed the to muscle. Send the skeletons through the hole first. That's right. That's the thing.
Everybody, yeah.
This is a fatal flaw of this episode.
That's why if they had gone to the toilet and turned Tywin into a White Walker, they could benefit from his tactics.
All right, let me ask you this. I can sometimes get a little bit weary of like a commander with a motivational speech, like before a big battle or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So Jon giving his little motivational speech to the wildlings, that could have gone bad in a number of ways, but I think it lasted just as long as it needed to. I don't feel like, because if it's too short, then it's like, oh geez, you just changed their mind overnight.
Right.
You've been fighting each other for 4,000 years and you were just able to Tony Robbins them into changing their mind.
Right. And this is a group that is less bound by an oath that they took. It's more about an ideology.
Mm-hmm. And I think maybe another show might have painted them as this massive monolithic people. And so you just need one guy to change his mind. But I think they've done a good job of establishing like Thens, not even the wildlings, like the Thens. And right. Then, you know, there's no way you're going to get all of these people to agree, but your hope is
especially because there's already talk about how what a incredible feat it was that Mance was able to do what he did.
That's right. That's right. There was that moment where that the motherly wildling lady, she says goodbye to her children.
Yeah.
And you really have no sense yet that anything bad's going to happen, because there's no hint that anything bad's going to happen.
Right.
But she's putting her kids in the boat and she says, I'm right behind you. I'll be there soon. And immediately, I don't know if you had the sense, but immediately I thought, uh-oh.
Yeah. No, they don't normally say, you don't normally say goodbye to kids and then be like, okay, well then, and then, you know, 4 minutes later, well, I got a little seasick, but that was a fine ride.
So did you see that coming?
Well, Game of Thrones has gotten me conditioned for peril.
Right.
So here's an interesting thing about her. I really enjoyed her. So little screen time.
Yeah, don't get attached.
But man, I think she made the most of every scene.
Maybe she has like a grand total of 5 minutes of screen time or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty memorable impact just for that short amount of time.
Well, to the point where when she passes, you're actually moved. That's an economy of screen time. And I think that's a testament to the way she's written, directed, and how it's performed. And Heather brought it up because she's just not having the Dorne daughters or those, man, just none of it. I mean, you think I don't like it, man. And so she used this character and this performance as a juxtaposition. She's like, I believe this person is authentically badass. And I have seen very little of her, and I am upset that she's not on the show anymore.
So that woman was great, and I really liked that you I like that you used the respectful euphemism "she passes."
Yeah.
That's how much she had an effect on you.
Yeah. No, for sure.
Like, you're actually
I'm showing respect.
I don't even know this woman's name.
No, I don't cheapen her journey. It was important.
Yeah, no, I get it.
Yeah, I mean, I have no problem saying that Theon got his wiener cut off, but this woman passed.
She passes. All right, so that's right. And now the giant's name is 1-1. Did you know that?
Did not know that.
Okay, it's spelled W-U-N and then new word, W-U-N. And as far as we know, 1-1 is like the last giant.
Why don't we, when a W and a U are together, just call it a triple U?
A triple U.
Yeah, so if I said triple U-N, then...
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it just seems...
You make some good points, Steve. I'm going to take it to the academic community, and we'll workshop that a little bit, and I'll bring it back.
I can't wait for the paper to be written. Triple U, mm-hmm. Exploring how we refer to W's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some room. There's some room to work in that area.
And I'm going to start referring to just use as single use in solidarity. I mean, I don't want to talk about the fact that it's really two V's, but that's not one battle at a time.
Yeah. All right. So I think that the thing that was most affecting for me was after this massive fight that just seemed like it was never going to end. John's on the boat, just kind of staring down the White Walker King.
By the way, you got a lot of boats this season. So I'm kind of taken by surprise that you have as many issues with this particular season when it's real boat heavy.
I like the boats, man. I love it. I want to see him on the water. I like to see 1-1 like walking waist deep in the ocean, like next to a boat. I just like it. I mean, I would have liked it better if Tyrion wasn't in a box the entire trip.
But he's got so much boat. Do you feel any different about season 5 thus far compared to, you know?
I do. I feel like it was it's unnecessarily derided.
I'm telling you, I think we've mentioned this before. I said so far with the Dorne, this is the season that has the most worst things in it.
Like this episode has zero Dorne, right?
Right.
And I think that is maybe why it's almost universally hailed as like one of the top people's top two or three episodes, because I think it's like, okay, Dorne came before it. Dorne comes after it, and you're just so relieved that there's no Dorne that you're like, yeah, fine, give me Winnie the Pooh zombie. I will take it over Dorne.
Well, and that's what I think is interesting, that we have that this is considered one of the best episodes of the series in a season that is considered one of the worst. And I feel like, how do those two things exist? There have been some episodes or moments in these episodes where I'm like, ugh. But overall, I'm like, we talked about a lot of really interesting things and about what we're seeing with Littlefinger's progression, Cersei's situation, and when the whole High Sparrow relationship, that's really interesting. And that's kind of, you know, that's not like anything we've really seen so far. So there's a lot to be said for this season in terms of what it's, even if it doesn't cash in on it all, what it's creating is highly compelling. And if you
one of the great moments, I think one of the great moments, like, I'm always of the mind that an action adventure is only as good as the villain is compelling. That's always been my thing. And this show has lots of villains, but I think that the big baddie is supposed to be the White Walker King,
which we've only seen twice.
Yeah. And we know almost zero about this guy. We don't know what motivates him. Like, he's the anti-Magneto.
Right.
And yet that scene where he's just staring down John, kind of waiting, like waiting for dramatic effect and raising his arms. And then you see all the dead rise and just stand there.
Yeah.
That was, that could be one of the most memorable scenes of the show so far.
Right. And it, and what's so interesting, because Joffrey dies and Tywin dies, and we're like, in the same way with Robert, like, well, who's the good that we're rooting for? Well, who's the bad that we're rooting? And then like Littlefinger starts to really show that he's manipulating all this stuff. But then you kind of understand that if you juxtapose and go, what Littlefinger's doing is damaging to some specific people for his own climb. But then the Night King shows up and goes, you don't know what bad is, because Littlefinger is just, by comparison, if you're like, if this is one of our main baddies, well, yeah, to what end? What's he going to do? He's going to get a little title.
Well,
here,
it's interesting that you put those two together, because I think I haven't thought about those two side by side, but if you could make the argument that everything that Littlefinger has done so far in the show is weakening the kingdom.
Right.
You know, he's assassinating dudes. He's causing strife between houses. And everything that he's done so far has weakened the internal Seven Kingdoms to the extent that when the White Walkers do decide to march south,
they're all splintered.
They're all splintered. They have no strength left.
There's glimpses, right? There's a glimpse of like kind of with, you know, because we've already seen it with the Wildlings and the Night's Watch saying, look, we got bigger fish to fry. Like, they get it. Interesting that like John's the one that's leading it, because he's kind of stepped out of it for a little bit, and like who would have thought that by virtue of the Night's Watch gives him the ability to have a little bit more bigger picture perspective, because the Night's Watch is such a specific role. Once you step outside the walls, you're more aware of what's at stake, and the rules change. I mean, as far as we know, I mean, we know this Night King is a king, but I don't know how his system of government works, or if
well,
there is
one. Well, we know
one.
he takes care of little babies.
Well, he turns babies into something. So there's that sense of like,
they're little incest babies. They, sure. You know, no one.
There's plenty to go harvest.
Which is really why the Night King wants to come south. He's heard about all of the incest babies.
He's like, man, this place is teeming with them.
The other big reveal this episode was that Sansa interrogates Theon and discovers that Bran and Rickon are alive.
Have we seen them at all this season?
They have not had one appearance this season.
Isn't that wild?
It's a little bit wild, and I had to look it up to make sure, because I was like, wait, what did
dude, yeah, like, the last time we saw him, they were in like, you know, the bowels of a tree or whatever with.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So we haven't seen them at all. No Hodor this entire season.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and this is where, you know, Heather loves herself, the brand narrative. And I don't think we've had this discussion, so I think I'll reveal this truth, because she insists that it's really interesting, and I am not as interested. I mean, I don't disinterested. I think it's just, I'm, this season for me is proving that, like, yeah, we can live without it.
So what's her stance on this?
Well, she really loves the brand narrative, but I'm also, my challenge is going to be, well, we've just went through 8 episodes with no Bran. Are you left wanting, or have you forgotten?
Mm-hmm. You know what she's going to, if I was in her position, I would say, yeah, just delete all of the Dorne stuff. Give me Bran instead, and I'll be pretty happy.
Yeah. No, and you know, there's an argument to be made that that's the trade, and it was a bad trade. Then Arya's selling oysters. I'm not quite sure what to do with all that.
Do you want, okay, number one, are you a shellfish fan?
Yes. Well, let's define shellfish, right? Because I think shellfish gets, it's a term that's used more broadly than I think it should be.
Are you a mollusk fan?
That's a better question. So our mollusks, we're looking at oysters, we're looking at clams.
Scallops. Do you also think a scallop would be a mollusk?
I am to a point.
Because my wife thinks it's like sucking down snot. That's mm-hmm. her feeling on it. I can't get enough. I mean, give me all the snot. I love
so
it.
You will. You'll crush a plate of oysters.
I will crush a plate of oysters. But would I put vinegar on it? I don't know. What do you? How would you feel about or number one? How do you feel about oysters? Number two, how would you feel about vinegar?
Love oysters. I usually put a little vinegar and big, those big old chunks of rock salt.
Okay. All right. So this, you're all over that. You'd be uh-huh. okay.
Oh, yeah. And Heather's, you know, pretty lukewarm. She's kind of in that snot category, but she's discovered mm-hmm. that she likes the smaller, the ones that are a little more, you know, a little more tight, less snotty.
Less snot.
Yeah. Less of a cold, more of, man, I've been working out in the dirt all day.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, the very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for podcasts that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
I have a very half-baked literary theory.
Okay.
I want to run it past you.
Sure.
Okay. So I was reading this chapter. I don't know how many times I read this chapter, but I was reading this chapter last night and I thought, I think that there's a little nod to Dante's Inferno.
Ooh.
In this chapter. And so let me lay it on you.
Okay. I'm intrigued.
All right. So when Ned gets up, if you're not familiar with Dante's Inferno, it's a medieval guy gets a tour of hell. That's the whole premise.
Yep. So
So Dante, he discovers a gate into hell in the wilderness, And then he like finds levels upon levels upon levels, and there's seven, you know, there's seven levels. And of course, how many times has Robert like cursed seven hells, right?
Yes.
So I first got this clue when he walks down the steps into the royal apartments, and it's like blazing hot. It's like, it is like there's two fireplaces going, the whole place glows red. And it's just insufferable heat. He can't do it. And yeah. I thought, oh, this guy's walking down. He opens the doors. There's like fiery stuff happening. And I thought, you know what? Megara's Holdfast is a little bit like layers within layers. Like Ned has to cross one threshold and then he has to cross another threshold. And then there's like a dry moat. And then he has to go past a guard and a guard, and then he has to walk down steps. And I thought, this is very kind of layers within layers. That reminds me of Dante's hole, basically.
Yeah.
And then he gets down and he finds that his best friend is dying, and they explain, well, it was a boar that did it. And immediately Robert says, a devil.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, okay, I get it. I get it. And then I was thinking, I wonder if there's more parallels here. So at that point, now, you know, you start to see these things, right? You start to say, this is a little echo of a literary homage. Now I'm going to start, like, over-reading the text.
Is there such a thing?
Yeah, right. Yeah, so then I'm starting to see things that are probably pretty weak. But, for instance, he has to pass three white cloaks. And three is a big deal in the Inferno. There's symbolism of the threes in Dante's Inferno, and Ned notes it as significant. He sees three. He has to pass three white cloaks, and he makes a note to himself. He's like, oh geez, three, because that's the number that he's just dreamt of. And it sounds a little bit like something weird's going to happen now. This doesn't feel right. I noticed the number three here, and it signifies something to me. And then the last thing I was going to point out is that before Robert dies, he calls it a pig. Like, he's like laughing at himself. He's like, I can't believe I was killed by a pig. And that reminded me of Chaco, because Chaco he's like a glutton. And so he's on that level of hell. And here we have Robert the glutton, and he was killed by a pig. And then finally, I remembered that, why did Robert go out in the first place? He went out to find the white stag. Well, in English lore, so I'm moving from Italy to England now, but in English lore, the white stag represents the questing beast, and it represents sort of a knight's spiritual journey, but of course it can't be caught. So Robert can't catch the white stag. What does he catch? He catches a pig. And that's just exactly Robert.
Wow.
And the whole point to Dante's Inferno is that the life you live on the surface is exactly the life you're choosing to live in the pit.
Yeah.
So Chaco, who's a glutton in real life, is going to be on the level of hell that's all about gluttony. And of course, I think that that's Robert. I think that's exactly Robert. Robert's chosen to live a certain kind of life on the surface. And read this one little part here. He says, a devil, the king husked. My own fault. Too much wine. Damn me to hell.
Ah.
All right. So how often has he said hells in this book? He always says seven hells. This is the first time he's actually said it in the singular.
Wow.
And so I thought, okay, maybe Martin knows what he's doing here. And then finally, and I think this is intentional too, he says, missed my thrust, which I think could be a sexual euphemism. He's never been able to hit the mark with Circe.
Father, a child. Yeah,
that's right. And this is his ultimate sin, that he's so gluttonous that he's in whorehouses and whatnot. He's always been missing his thrust his entire life. And so that's the kind of hell he's going to. That is my theory.
I love it. I am intrigued. Now I'm going to have to go back and reread the entire chapter that was not in my mindset when I read through this, but I think you lay out a really, really good case for that. It would be, you know, you and I have talked about reader's interpretation versus author's intent, right? Mm-hmm. It would, however, be interesting to maybe dig something up and see if Martin has ever said, right, uh-huh. that he had these certain kind of literary themes in mind. But regardless, I think that that is compelling. I think there is a lot of evidence
for
that.
Well, it's one of those times where you're like, I guess this particular reading of the chapter kind of thrilled me.
Yeah.
And does the rest of it even matter? Like, do we even care what Martin thinks? Because it very
no,
well could
we
be
don't.
That he comes out and he says, yeah, I've never read The Inferno.
Yeah. And that might be the case, right? But it ultimately,
to me at least,
ultimately it's your interpretation, right? Uh-huh. And the meaning that you find in it. Like we talked before on the podcast about his views of war and pacifism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it is interesting, right, to think about what was in an author's mind. I told you I'm teaching Harry Potter this semester.
Right. Yeah.
And we did an entire class just on alchemy and, you know, Carl Jung and, you know, how that really, really framed up so much of what Rowling did in her narrative. Mm-hmm. But again, ultimately, it's what we take away from that. It's the meaning that we ascribe to it. And I love it. I love that interpretation. Again, I hadn't thought of that. I'm also wondering, too, you know, the different sins. You know, you mentioned gluttony. Do you see evidence in here of other kind of sins that lead to a certain trajectory based on what we know about characters? Do you find hints of that here beyond Robert? Mm. Like, you know, deception and treachery and...
That's a good question. I mean, betrayal is the worst, right?
Yeah.
And I think that we have right at the end of the chapter, well, maybe even is a theme. I mean, we know that, I was going to say that we know that Littlefinger is betraying Ned.
There are lots of betrayals going on here.
As they speak, Littlefinger is betraying Ned. And betrayal is sort of the bottom of the pit. But it could be that that's a larger theme, that how do you best honor Robert's final wishes? You kind of have to betray him, don't you? You kind of have to, like, hear what he says, kind of understand what he means, do the opposite because that's the right thing to do despite Robert's wishes. So Ned is in this really impossible place where in order to honor the king's legacy, he has to betray the king.
Right.
And that could be interesting. Like at this point, I'm really looking for, you know, I'm really digging trying to support my theory. But if you read the Divine Comedy, betrayal is the worst. It's worse than gluttony. It's worse than deception. It's worse than anything. To do what Judas did is the worst possible thing you could do, and I think that might be an overarching theme for Ned's story arc.
You see this across a lot of, you know, literary tales. This idea of betrayal, right? No matter what else you do, or what your characters or what your motivations are, betrayal is always kind of portrayed, right, as like the worst possible thing you can do to somebody else. Mm. And I think you're right. If you look at, you know, Ned's impossible situation, because he knows Robert, he knows that Robert doesn't have the full scope of information. And that if Robert did have the full scope of information, his last wishes would be very different. So Ned has to think beyond, mm-hmm. you know, Robert obviously doesn't know that Jeffrey is not his son. Therefore, I have to kind of go beyond this, even if it is not exactly what Robert told me to do. And do the right thing, right? Make the right decision. Mm-hmm. And so going back to your first point, Ned, you know, is driven by what's right, but in this moment he has to make certain calculations to do the right thing beyond, right, what he's told to do by his king, which mm-hmm. itself is a betrayal. You're right.